Right, I will call this meeting of the House Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. It is Thursday, March 17th, 2022, and we are holding this meeting remotely under Rule 10.01. We're going to start with the roll. Michaela, please go ahead.
Beckerson.
Present.
Mueller.
Present.
Scott.
Here.
Feist.
Present.
Frazier.
Present.
Grossel.
Present.
Herr.
Present.
Hollins.
Present.
Johnson.
Present.
Liebling.
Present.
Long.
Present.
Mortensen.
Present.
Rovatny.
Body present.
Farr.
Farr present.
Robbins.
Present.
Fang. Representative Fang. Representative Zhang.
Present.
All right. Representative Vang is excused. I know she let me know she had a hearing in another committee. So she'll be joining us as soon as she can. So we do have a quorum present. We'll go ahead with the minutes. Vice Chair Mueller, will you move the minutes of March 15th?
I move, Madam Chair.
All right. The minutes of March 15th are before us. Any discussion to the minutes, members? Seeing no hands, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? And the minutes are adopted from March 15th, 2022. Gonna get right to it. As I had explained to folks at the end of Tuesday's hearing, first we're gonna go to Representative Frazier's House File 4200. The amendment was properly filed on time and in the right format. Representative Frazier, would you like to move House File 4200 today?
Madam Chair, that is my motion.
All right. And then would you like to move the A1 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. And members, as you remember, the A1 amendment is the one we did discuss on Tuesday. So we're not going to take any further discussion at this point. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right. The A1 is adopted. We can go right ahead to the roll. Representative Frazier, if you want to just say a couple words just for the record to remind folks what this bill is and what we discussed on Tuesday, that would be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A1 amendment just adds to the 4200 bill. It deals with the body camera language. We've adopted the language as proposed by the governor through the DPS or BCA agency. Specifically, Superintendent Drew Evans testified to the bill language, and it just provides for transparency and accountability to build trust between law enforcement and community.
All right, thank you. Representative Frazier renews his motion that House File 4200 as amended be referred to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Beckerson?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
No.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel?
No.
Herr?
Aye.
Hollins?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
No.
Rovatny?
No.
Farr?
No.
Robbins?
No.
Fang? Excused. Zhang?
Aye.
That is 9 ayes and 7 nays.
All right. House File 4200, as amended, is referred to the Public Safety Committee. Moving right along, members, the next bill on our agenda is a Representative Hansen J. bill. I will move House File 3380 be referred to the Human Services Committee. Just want to make sure we've got Representative Hansen here. Yep. Representative Hansen, would you also like me to move the A1 amendment?
Good morning, Madam Chair. You guys moved so quick this morning in your committee. Yes, I would like to move my A1 amendment, please.
All right. So I will move the A1 amendment. Representative Hansen, can you just tell us quickly what the A1 does?
Yes, I can. So the A1 amendment is the result of conversations that were had between a number of different stakeholders who are going to be responsible for really implementing this language out in communities. And so the important piece of this is one, let me just get to my notes here, excuse me. And so DHS worked with MACSA and MCAA to prepare this piece of it. The amendment addresses questions that MACSA had at my last committee in Human Services. It deletes a proposed definition of kin. It incorporates its intent instead of its into the definition of relative. The phrase important friend is also deleted, and the bill is used with relatives because that definition of relative actually includes important friend, which is an important part of this conversation. It also deletes references to the repealed Chapter 257A, modifies a section related to child removals by law enforcement to clarify that law enforcement can coordinate with a local agency, and a number of other things. And I'm happy to answer any other questions about the amendment if you'd like. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hansen. It is a long one, so I will appreciate when it's engrossed. But thank you for that that explanation. Members, any questions about the amendment? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This is a really important bill, and so I just thank you for taking the time to hear about this bill today. I come to you with a bill that will have a significant impact on the lives of children and families in the child protection system throughout Minnesota. The vast majority of people agree that foster care and placement should always be a last resort for children who cannot remain safely at home with their primary caregiver. We know that children experiencing foster care are at a higher risk of negative outcomes later in life, particularly when they remain in foster care for an extended period of time, or if they age out of the system without permanency. Family preservation matters to the well-being of children and their opportunities to thrive with less symptoms of trauma later in life. If a child must be removed from their home, placement with relatives preserves relationships and can reduce trauma for the child and the child's entire family. Preservation of a child's family and their connection to their community improves overall child welfare and outcomes for everybody involved. And these decisions that we make in these moments not just affect these kids and families here with us today, but has impacts on generations that we haven't met yet and that are yet to come. In Minnesota in 2020, American Indian and Indigenous children were 16.4 times more likely than white children to be removed from their homes. African American and Black children were 2.4 times more likely to be removed than white children. And children of two or more races were 6.8 times more likely to experience these out-of-home placements when compared to the removal of white children. These disparities for Indigenous kids and their families are some of the worst in the nation. And with some of us who see too many similarities between today's child protection system and boarding schools of the past. While this legislation is going to impact all children in the child welfare system, given the inequitable experiences and the overrepresentation of Black and African American kids, kids of two or more races, and Indigenous kids to whom ICWA does not apply, we expect that this legislation will just begin to close at least some of the gaps leading to these disparities. I also want to highlight that the majority of families in the child protection system have very low incomes. And the day-to-day battles with poverty can often look like neglect when a child's family does not have the resources to meet their kids' needs. The socioeconomic burden facing too many families must not be confused with a family's lack of desire to secure the resources to better support their little ones. Individualized case and safety plans emphasized in this bill are critical aspects to identifying and addressing the unique needs of every child and family. Okay, members, so now that we know we need to do better at helping families together, and we also know that we need to do better at finding solutions to the inequities that this system is producing, now it's time to act. This bill seeks to tackle many of these concerns and more. I'll highlight just a few key points that I think members of this committee are particularly interested in. This bill clarifies that safety plans and out-of-home placement plans must be individualized to the needs of the child and their family and include support persons from the child's extended family, kin network, and community. It clarifies that the court's reviews of these plans must consider whether services and actions were culturally appropriate, individualized, and selected collaboratively with the child and family. It modifies the definition of relative, as is used in the juvenile protection proceedings, to be more inclusive of a culturally and family-defined relatives. It requires peace officers to coordinate with local social service agencies when children are removed from unsafe situations, and then when a relative is identified as a placement resource by the child or the child's parent or custodian. This bill clarifies that the best interest factors are to be considered as a whole, that one factor alone cannot be used to the exclusion of others, and that the child's current and future needs and relationship must be taken into consideration when making foster and adoptive placement decisions. Two more points I want to highlight. It clarifies that the placement decisions must be made in according to all of the items in the placement decisions section, not just best interest factors. Such items include relative and sibling placement considerations. This bill reorganizes and expands the section that outlines an agency's relative search requirements to clarify that the various steps involved ensure greater court oversight, and it clarifies that such a requirement cannot be waived or relieved in its entirety. This bill clearly states that agencies must continue to engage and consider relatives even after findings are made regarding reasonable efforts at completing the initial relative search, that relatives can change their minds about wanting to be a permanent resource for a child, and that relatives that were ruled out as foster care placements can still be considered for adoption. One of the last points I'll make is that this bill allows relatives and foster parents to file motions for adoptive placements, even if they do not have an approved adoption home study, as long as they submit an affidavit signed by the agency with whom they're working with to complete an adoption home study. And it specifies the procedures and timelines for hearing and granting such motions. So as you can tell, there's a lot covered in this bill, and there are so many great pieces. And I could honestly talk about it for a lot longer, but I think I've taken enough of your time today, and I will digress. There's 8 pages of changes in the materials that were submitted to the committee, and I encourage members to take a peek at that. There's some things we'll continue to talk about and change and strengthen. But to sum it up, these changes are needed simply to do better by children and families who need our help. And with that, Madam Chair, I have DHS here to answer any questions that your committee might have.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hansen. As she mentioned, we do have some folks here from DHS and some other places to answer questions if we have them, but we don't have any testifiers signed up. So we will move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the bill's author, Representative Hansen, you, in your comments just now, said that a family may qualify to adopt but wouldn't qualify to be a foster parent. How would it be that you would qualify to adopt but not be qualified somehow to be a foster parent?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott. The process through which to become qualified to foster is often shorter, and so families may or may not have known foster was needed during that time. They may not have been open to the idea of being a foster at that time. There may have been changes in the home. As you know, with foster care, there's a ton of requirements a family may have to meet that they may not have been able to meet in that time frame, but by the time an adoption is available, hopefully the families will have worked with the agencies or worked with other resources who could potentially help them get some of those in place. And I'll defer to DHS for any other specific examples, but those are just a few.
Representative Scott, do you want to hear from DHS as well?
Madam Chair, yeah, this is an important issue to me. So if they could expound on that, I would appreciate it.
All right. I know we have Matt Burdick. If it's somebody else, just go ahead and unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and go ahead with your response.
Good morning. My name is Autumn Baum, and I am the Legislative Coordinator for Child Safety and Permanency Division at DHS. Members of the committee, Madam Chair, I am going to refer you to our agency policy specialist in adoption and kinship. Her name is Heidi, and she's going to answer your question, Representative Scott. Thank you.
All right. Heidi, if you could introduce yourself and go ahead.
Sure, Madam Chair, or members of the committee. My name is Heidi Ombiso-Scalet, and I'm the adoption and kinship policy specialist at DHS. So one of the other examples in this case would be if a child has been in foster care for an extended period of time and initially a relative, as Representative Hansen had mentioned, if a relative hadn't wanted to be a permanency resource or was not able to be a permanency resource for whatever reason, maybe not able to do it due to living too far away from the family and they're working on reunification efforts at the time, or you know, maybe just had a newborn themselves and are parenting, you know, a young child at that age, or there's other reasons for not potentially being a foster care placement at that time, that would not then cause them to not be considered as an adoptive resource at a later stage, especially, as I said, if the child has been in foster care for several years.
Follow up, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for that answer. I do have another question, and Representative Hansen, you mentioned a lot of statistics of disparities in certain communities, and I'm wondering if other states have done what this bill is doing and if it has had an effect on those disparities, if you know the answer to that question.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott. You know, I'm not up to date with what's happening in other states, but what I can tell you is that the conversation about disparities in child protection systems is a national conversation. It has been a conversation that's been happening for a number of years. And so if DHS knows what's happened in other states, I would love to hear from them. I am good at Minnesota policy. That's what I stick to.
Ms. Ombiso-Scalet, if you have any follow-up.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Scott. We do know that relative placements do help out in terms of issues related to diligent recruitment requirements under the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act and their inter-ethnic adoption provisions. So that one requires that states and agencies receiving the 40 funds that they also make diligent efforts to recruit foster and adoptive families that reflect the racial and ethnic diversity of children in need of foster and adoptive homes. And so one of the ways that states can do that is by seeking foster and adoptive resources from within the child's own family. And so in that way, it would help in terms of that federal law, and then potentially with also reducing disparities once within foster care. In terms of removing children, you know, from their homes and reducing disparities in that regard, a lot of what this bill does is it strengthens existing federal requirements and state requirements. And so our hope is that it will help reduce some of the disparities around removals in the first place, which would then have a snowball effect later on as you know, they don't enter foster care and can remain within their families.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, and this will be my final question to Ms. Ombiso-Scalet. Do you plan on keeping track of that data then?
Ms. Ombiso-Scalet.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Scott. Yes, we will be keeping track of that data as it is entered into our Social Services Information System, or SSIS. So that will come out hopefully as part of our annual reports that we do submit every year.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Hansen. There's probably three of us on this committee that have dealt with somewhat regularly dealt with child placement. Unfortunately, we were at the front end of it where we had to actually be the ones that had to remove the child from the family. It's a very difficult situation to do. But I do know that once the decision has been made, it's a decision that's not taken very lightly. It's through a lot of work and a lot of concerns for the well-being of the child. I remember working with our child protection, doing multiple stops at the homes before we finally had to physically remove the children from the home. We didn't like doing it. But 2 weeks later in the court, when the children are there, seeing smiles on their face, seeing they're clean, seeing them happy for a change. It's a tough decision to make. So I do have some concerns about this because I know at least in my community, child protection did a lot of things before they physically removed a child. They did everything they could. They worked with relatives. They worked with the parents. They worked with the mother, the father. They did everything they could not to remove that child. I'm looking at the bill and stuff, and I do have during the conversation, I had a question for Ms. Ambas Colette. I got to remember it now. I didn't get a chance to write it down. But the concerns I have in this is this, in the long run, going to cause more problems? We have an issue across the state with foster care. The regulations to get to be a foster parent, to temporarily take care of these children, is a long process. The adoption process is even longer. I'm passionate about that issue because I am an adoptee. So I take these issues very carefully and very seriously. Because what I'm looking for is what's best for the child. We have to look at the best interests of the child. If we can keep it in the family, that is great. But we have to make sure that the family is going to actually do what's in the best interest of the child. I've seen it where we've had to remove the child from the foster relative or the foster care that was a relative because their only interest was the financial interest they were receiving for being the foster parent. They didn't give a damn about the child. So we have to make sure that we're doing things correctly and properly. Now, I do remember that question from Ms. Amabis Colette. Now, currently, when a child is taken into protective custody and given to a foster care unit, and a relative might come forward for adoption or for being that foster parent while working things out with the real parents and hopefully get that child back into the custody of their parent. Is there anything in the rules and laws and regulations that we have on this now that it couldn't be done without changing this law?
Ms. Ambisa Scallet.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson. So if I'm understanding, I just want to make sure I understand the question. Representative Johnson, you're asking if there's anything that's currently in the law that would allow the foster parent or the relative to step forward and become an adoptive resource for the child, even if the child's currently in a foster placement right now that isn't relative care?
Representative Johnson, is that what you're asking?
That is correct, whether it's adopted or foster care.
All right. Ms. Ambisa Scallet.
Okay, thank you, Representative Johnson. I just wanted to confirm that. Yes, that is currently the law that allows relatives to step forward and be considered for foster care placement or adoptive placement. The bill would strengthen that consideration and would allow or would also clarify some language around when a relative hadn't responded initially to the notice that they would have received once the child had entered foster care, and then later comes forward and says that they would like to be considered for placement. So it would clarify some of those items related to agencies being able to consider those relatives and those relatives having the ability to come forward at that point.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, I appreciate the answer because it can be done now, and I know in my area they do that. They do their best for the child. They put the child's best interest above anything else. There are some other things I have a little concerns on this bill, but I will let us keep on moving forward with it. And I haven't made my decision how I'm going to vote on this bill yet, because like I say, I do have a number of concerns.
Representative Hansen, do you want to respond at all to any of that?
Yes, please, Madam Chair. I just thank you, Representative Johnson, for highlighting the need to make sure that we are doing what's best by kids. That's what's most important here. And if you support making sure that we are doing the best thing for kids and improving our existing system, this is the bill for you, because this is what we're trying to do in this. There have been a number of reports that have come out, a really great one, I believe it was in Mother Jones in January, that really talked about a lot of disparities and the types of changes that we need to make in our child protection system. And a number of those are covered in this bill. And so my background's in social work. I know I have not been in front of your committee a whole lot, but the important piece is making sure we're looking at the entire person's situation. A person-centered approach matters. Family preservation matters. Making sure that we're respecting the dignity and worth of children matters, right? And right now, we need to make these changes to our statutes in order to say in legislation that that matters. And so I hope that helps in your decision about voting on the bill, because it is, from what I'm hearing you say, at least, exactly what you're looking for.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. And I'll just note, too, I think it's more than three members of this committee who have either worked around or been impacted by the child protection system. I can tell you, as a Native person growing up on the reservation, that my family members certainly had experience with some of the negative outcomes that Representative Hansen is speaking to. And I think ultimately what's best for the kid can also mean that they aren't separated long-term from their families. And I think that, I can speak from my own experience, just because somebody isn't in a place in that moment to take a child on short notice. I mean, that's the thing to remember too, is like, this is often short notice that families are asked to step up as foster parents, and they might not be in the right place. I know I've been asked to be one before. I don't know if other people on this committee are, I have a large family. I've gotten those letters asking, and one of the times I had a newborn at home. That wasn't the right moment. But if that relative had needed care further down the road, maybe it would be a different answer. And so I think keeping that in mind, that people's situations change over time, is really, really important as we discuss this issue. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Hansen, for bringing this bill forward. I think it's long overdue. This is a really important issue. And I feel compelled to speak on it because I had a number of friends who were impacted by this system when I was growing up. And fortunately, my mom is a social worker, and so she knew how to work within the system to make sure that we still were able to see each other. And we ended up being a lifeline for a lot of those kids. My family did, because they were able to still spend the night with us and see us regularly and have play dates when they had been completely ripped from their regular day-to-day activities. And you know, I'm still friends with a lot of those individuals, and they tell me that being able to be with familiar faces in a regular sort of normal family setting where they just felt like it was an everyday sleepover made a huge difference for them. And I know that a lot of folks don't get the chance to do that because they don't understand, you know, all the pre-approvals that we had to go through in order to have those friends over because they were in the foster care system. So I know that maintaining connections with, you know, pre-established family and friends is just so important for those kids and for their well-being. And I also need to speak on this because of my personal experience within practicing family law. You know, I think it's, we can all admit that some families are problematic, but I do want to acknowledge that bias exists in the system, and we're all biased in one way or another, whether or not we choose to acknowledge that. And the reality is kids are not removed from their families in equitable ways. And I know this because I had a family who had a child removed because she allowed the child to walk to the school bus stop by themselves. And everybody in the family thought that was horrific. And I think most people would say that's a pretty normal thing to allow your kid to do. But they were told that that was incredibly dangerous and there's no way she should be able to keep her children. And I don't think that would have happened if she had been a white mom in the suburbs, you know, and she was just trying to make breakfast for her other kids before she started her second shift at another job. So the reality is the system doesn't treat children and families equitably, and we need to do something to correct that. So I really applaud this bill. I applaud your efforts. I thank all the stakeholders for being involved in this because it is so crucial. And, you know, we have to work. I mean, accepting that it is the way it is not good enough. We absolutely have to push forward because we know what's happening now isn't working. And so, you know, fully recognizing that we might have to come back to this and revisit it later, right, and make additional tweaks. But I think that this is a great start. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen. I heard this bill in HHS and supported it, but I honestly have a few questions with the DE, so or the author's amendment, I'm sorry. So if you would just go to, and unfortunately my copy doesn't quite line up with what's in the amendment, so I'm just gonna tell you what I'm referencing. So in of the amendment on 1.8, it references relative and changing statute 26C and changing the definition of relative. And so it looks to me like you've deleted all the important friend references, but you've now incorporated important friend into the definition of relative. And I do have some concerns about that. So could you explain to me why you're making that change?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Robbins. And so this amendment was fully drafted between after Human Services, as you're aware. MAXA was there and had some concerns about a few things. So following Human Services, MAXA and DHS came together to say, okay, DHS has the vision, if you will, and MAXA has the responsibility to implement. Many of their folks will. And so this was a collaborative effort between them to agree on some of that. So just to kind of clarify where this came from, it was directly from people who are front lines doing this work every single day. And the importance of an important friend is very similar to what Representative Hollins just talked about. That having a family friend or someplace that they can go potentially in an emergency situation while the agency finds a longer-term foster placement, et cetera, it matters to the kid. It gives them a sense of peace. It gives them a sense of familiarity rather than putting them with a stranger. And I think that at the surface, we can kind of all agree that it is probably better for a kid to go with a friend who is a safe place for them versus the stress that it puts them through to go with a stranger. I will also encourage or ask either Autumn or Heidi to comment on this because they talk about this really well, and I think it's interesting to kind of hear their response on this.
Thank you. Ms. Umbisa Scallet.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hansen. I'll add to those two. Representative Robbins, there's also a sort of more technical explanation too that hopefully will help clarify this as well. So the current definition of relative under Chapter 260C already includes important friends of a child. So this amendment, rather than having a separate definition for important friends of the family, or the parents, I should say, we just instead incorporated it right into the definition of relative so that all of the kin definitions are in one definition rather than having them separated out. And so instead of it just being important friends of the child, it would be important friends of the child as well as the child's parent or custodian. And that has to do with, like, I can give a quick example as to why that came up as well. So in the case of, say, a newborn in the hospital who wouldn't have important friends yet because they haven't been alive long enough to have important friends, this would allow the parents, family friends, for example, to be considered a foster resource as well. And so later on, had they been old enough, they would have eventually develop that important friend relationship with those individuals.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that explanation. I just, in follow-up, wondered who decides the important friend relationship? Is it, if it's too young, if it's a baby, then the parent decides, or does some outsider in the agency decide? And then, secondly, like, just to be clear,
can we let her answer that?
Yes.
Ms. Umbisa Scallet.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Robbins, the important friend relationship would be something that the county agency and the parents would work on together. So generally the parent would, you know, indicate individuals with whom they have significant relationships or are considered important family friends. And then the county agency would determine whether that, you know, important friend would be a placement resource for the child.
All right, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's really helpful. I appreciate that. So, but because this could just be anyone, like someone could call me and say, hey, can you take my kid? You know, will this important friend person eventually have to get foster licensed?
Ms. Umbisa Scallet is nodding, but if you want to say more. For the record.
Yes. Thank you. Representative Robbins, the individual that would need to be licensed for foster care, yes. And there's a provision that allows emergency placements when individuals are unlicensed to, you know, assuming that relatives generally just aren't already licensed for foster care. So they could go through the existing unlicensed emergency relative placement process and work towards becoming licensed.
Representative Robbins, any additional follow-up?
Just one question, unrelated. Thank you. So on 3.2 of the amendment, it refers to page 31, line 23, which honestly doesn't line up with my copy of the bill. I think it's going to fall under, where did I think I found it? 27, I think. But anyway, it says we're deleting after who, and again, inserting this important friend of the child or child's parent. But then it adds a definition, including an individual with whom the child has resided or had significant contact or who has had significant relationship to the child or the child's parent or custodian. So it seems like we're really enlarging the definition compared to the earlier definition we were talking about. So can you just explain to me why all that extra stuff is necessary? Because, like, what concerns me is we are fundamentally changing the definition and statute for all statute, what relative is. And so I just want to make sure we're getting this right, because this was not aired in HHS. And so I feel a little obliged for my colleagues to think about this.
So first, I will tell you, we are not changing the definition for everywhere in statute.
It We're not.
Applies to that. It's only that the way this, it's only that chapter of statute that it would apply to. So if that's helpful, I can tell you
that is helpful.
That's true no matter what what statute or committee we're in, that if we're changing it just in that chapter, it would only apply within that chapter of statute. But Ms. Mbisa Scallet, if you want to say any more to that.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Robbins. I know that it does look like it's adding instances in there, but if you look at the bill, it would be at least the one that I am looking at, lines 31.21 through 31.26 in the current bill without the amendment. You'll see on what would be the third in that bill, which we're amending, with an individual who is an important friend with whom the child has resided or had significant contact. So that is already in an existing law. What we did is we just took the additional items that we added into the definition of relative, which would be the important friend of the child's parent or custodian, or the significant relationship piece, and we just inserted those into the existing preference there. And that particular section isn't so much about the definition of relative as much as how relatives are to be considered within the existing definition of relative, so for placement decision purposes.
All right, any further follow-up, Representative Robbins?
I just appreciate all the clarification, but I am concerned because anytime any other section of statute will reference this 2060C, it will carry this new language in it. So I do think it's broader than just this particular instance in Foster, and so I'm glad we had that discussion on the record. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yep, thank you, Representative Robbins. And I do think, you know, this is probably the right time to mention too, that, you know, I think this really brings up in this bill that different cultures think of family in different ways. And our statutes were really written with kind of one mindset of what family means. And I can tell you, as someone who grew up in the community I grew up in, is that many of the people we consider family and kin within my community are not legally considered family under current statute. And I think that's really the heart of what we're getting at here and why there's sort of that cultural piece. So I do want to sort of put that on the record that, you know, it varies based on the culture that you grew up in. And I think that's I can't speak for Representative Hansen, but I think that's part of what we're trying to get at with some of these sections of the bill. With that, I don't see any other hands up. So Representative Hansen, closing comments to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. Thank you, everybody who spoke up. Thank you for asking questions. These are important. It is important to get this right. It's important to look out for our kids. And so your contribution to this conversation and your comfort level and your support and your vote for this bill matters. Like I mentioned about one of the questions that came is, you know, if your goal is to make sure we fix and address a lot of the kind of horror stories that we've heard throughout the community, this is a step towards that. This is the kind of work that gets us to a better society, that treats kids more equitably, that treats families more equitably. This is the Minnesota way of asking the questions that families need us to ask and engaging them in the ways that they need us to engage them while also watching out and protecting the welfare of children. So I thank you for your time today, and I appreciate your support.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Hansen. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3380, as amended, be referred to the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Becker Finn.
Aye.
Mueller.
Aye.
Scott.
Aye. Excuse me, aye.
Feist.
Aye.
Frazier.
Aye.
Grossel. Representative Grossel? Her?
Aye.
Hollins?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
Aye.
Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Parr?
Parr, aye.
Robbins?
Aye.
Bang?
Aye.
John?
Aye.
Russell, aye.
That is 16 ayes and one nay.
All right, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to Human Services. Thank you, Representative Hansen, and our testifiers. The next bill on our agenda is House File 2849. I will move House File 2849 be referred to the General Register. This is a Chair Richardson bill. Chair Richardson, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that Chair Mariani would like to have the bill re-referred back to Public Safety before going to the General Register.
Got it. I will withdraw my motion, and the motion will be to move it to Public Safety Committee. Thank you for clarifying that, Chair Richardson. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2849 would build on bipartisan work that began last session with the creation of the Missing and Murdered African American Women and Girls Task Force. This bill would establish an office dedicated to addressing the known disparities and crisis of missing and murdered Black women and girls in our state. As this bill has been heard in Public Safety, I'll keep my comments to the section of the bill relevant to this committee. Subdivision 7 deals with access to data that is needed to perform the duties of the office and provides that the office will have access to confidential and private corrections and detention information, as the office will be responsible for tasks such as reviewing data on repeat offenders. Also under Subdivision 7, the office will have access to medical data, for example, to review overdose or suicide cases that occur under suspicious circumstances. As the staff of the office will be state employees, they'll be held to the state's duties and responsibilities related to the collection, storage, and inventory of data. The office would also be limited to accessing private or confidential data only to the extent necessary to administer or manage the duties of the office, and staff would be required to safeguard the data as well in compliance with statute and follow the requirements in statute follow requirements for disposal according to records retention schedules, rather. The office and its staff would also be subject to civil remedies and penalties and statutes for violations. Today, I have with me Kate Weeks with the Office of Justice Program, and she is standing by for questions as well.
All right. Thank you. And thank you very much for sticking to the sections of the bill that are relevant to our committee. Members, Chair Richardson noted, we don't have any testifiers today, but we do have folks on hand if we do have questions. So we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question one is, I see there's a fiscal cost to this of $500,000. It's not clear in the bill if that's for a biennium or if that's an annual cost. And I'm assuming that we're setting up a permanent office, so this would go into the tails as well.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott. That is correct. As this would be funded during a non-budget year, that would go into the tails for ongoing costs.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And my second question, Madam Chair, is Representative Richardson, was there any thought given to, with the sharing all this data, of getting the consent of a family member to have this data shared, kind of like we do with students, who are minors, their parents sign off on that? You know, when there's a missing or murdered African-American woman, can we go to the family and get their consent to have all this information shared about them, since you can't get the, obviously you can't get the consent of the individual?
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott, for the question. And I would just note that the approach and process here is reflective of the approach and process with the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives Office as well. And so the purpose behind this is to ensure that we are following that same structure and protocol that was improved just last year in statute as well.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it probably needs to be changed in both places, in my opinion. So I know that this bill has some further work, you know, it's going to some other committees. So I think it should be changed in both places before that kind of data is shared. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Not seeing any other hands up. Chair Richardson, closing comments before we vote on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to hear this bill and committee today. We were able to work on a bipartisan basis to get the task force across the finish line last year. We know that there's a crisis. We know that Black women and girls that are involved in missing and murdered cases, their cases stay open four times longer than cases involving other women. And this is really an opportunity to not only get to the root causes of the issues that impact those disparities, but to also to really begin to track on the rationale behind why Black girls don't get Amber Alerts in the same at the same rate as their white peers, why they're more likely to be classified as runaways. And more so, this is an opportunity for prevention and to also help to support families to try to get answers for those who have been missing without a trace. And as you have shared, Chair, previously, knowing that you have family members that have experienced that, I've had family that has gone missing as well without a trace. Every family deserves answers. So I ask for member support.
All right, thank you, Chair Richardson. With that, I will renew my motion that House Bill 2849 be referred to the Public Safety Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Eckerfin?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel?
Aye.
Herr?
Aye.
Collins?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
No.
Novotny?
Aye.
Farr?
Aye.
Robbins?
Aye.
Bang?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
That is 16 ayes and one nay.
All right, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to public safety. Thank you, Chair Richardson. Members, the last bill on our agenda today is mine, so I'm going to pass the gavel over to Vice Chair Mueller. So I'm passing you the gavel, but I will also move House File 3971 be referred to the Human Services Committee, and you now have the gavel, Vice Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So House File 3971 is now before us. It doesn't look like you have any amendments, so go ahead and tell us about your bill, please.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do want to save most of our time today for our testifiers. I think it's really important that we hear directly from them. Really simply, and this is a bill that we're referring to as Maya's Law, and you'll find out why in a couple of minutes. So essentially, right now, when there is a report of maltreatment and our government is charged with checking into that and investigating it, part of that process obviously is talking to the child about what happened. And right now, Minnesota is the only state that does not allow for the parent or the child to be interviewed away from the guardian. So obviously, if the guardian is the person perpetrating the abuse or part of the abuse, to have that child then provide their story to investigators with the potential abuser present is incredibly problematic and does not allow us to really get to the heart of what's going on to keep children protected. And so that's what this bill is about. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifiers. I believe Maya is here to testify herself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Maya White, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and you can begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Maya. Do I start now? Okay.
Yes, Chair, go right ahead.
Chair and members of the committee, thank you for giving me the chance to speak before you today. My name is Maya White, and I am 15 years old. I'm sure all of you are wondering why I'm here. That will become more clear in a minute. But before that, I want you to know who I am. As I said, my name is Maya. I live in Eden Prairie with my mom, my dad, and my little brothers. My parents are very supportive, and they are helping me figure out the kind of person I want to be, but also learning to be proud of who I am and where I've been. I'm always trying to be a better version of myself. In my younger years, I learned what it's like to live in a home with a single mom. Fortunately, we had the support of my amazing Nana. Without her, things in my life would have been different. Sounds like a typical childhood, right? What you might have suspected but didn't know is that I'm a survivor of child abuse. This has impacted me in many ways, and thanks to the support of my mom, dad, and Nana, I am a survivor. However, I might not have been when I was 12. I had to learn what it took to survive. I was struggling. I didn't feel safe, and my life was on autopilot. I wasn't really there. I didn't know how to feel or what to feel. It's hard to explain, but it's like forgetting your vocab and needing to learn it all over again. I was not safe with my biological father. He was known to a lot of people in Minnesota as a good guy. I knew he wore a mask for them. When I had to be alone with him, that mask came off. I knew what was happening was wrong, but the thought of telling someone what was happening to me scared me. I was afraid that the people I cared about wouldn't believe me, would treat me differently, or that it just make things worse. I felt like I had to be a sponge and protect my brother from the abuse. I was in sixth grade. Instead of heading out to recess, I would stay in my classroom because I was too scared to go outside. But then I made it up in my mind that I wasn't going to take his shit anymore, and I decided that day I was going to end this cycle. I realized I didn't want to grow up and wish I would have told someone what was happening. From there, I told my mom, my teacher, and anyone that would listen to me. I made sure my story was heard, and I made sure people knew what my side of the story was. I told anyone that would listen to me. I thought this was going to be the most difficult part. Little did I know at this time, this was just the beginning. I couldn't have known what would come next. After bringing this abuse all to the light, I was immediately faced with another scary reality. Not only did I have to tell my story to complete strangers, but I was also forced to do so in front of my abuser. I was so nervous and had so many thoughts, feelings, questions like, what will happen to me? Will I have to go home with the person after I just spilled everything? What if nothing gets better? I would not be here in front of you all today without the support of my dad, mom, and Nana. No one should have to be this tough, and not everyone is lucky enough to have the family I do. In Minnesota, children don't have the right to be interviewed separately from their parent, guardian, or caretaker, even when they are the abusers. This has got to change. No child should have to go through the same experience that I did. I support this law because I believe kids should not have to be afraid about the consequences of coming forward when they are being abused. Kids have a lot to say and should be granted a safe place to do so. Over the years, I have thought of multiple ways where I could end up in a place where I don't want to be. I have also thought about where I would be if my family weren't there alongside me during the most challenging part of my life. Right now, I'm making sure that I have a better future. I don't know what I want to do yet, but I know I want to be happy. I want the same thing for every other kid, but I can't do that on my own. Will you help support the vote of Bill HF3971, not only for me, but for all the Mayas out there who never got the chance to be heard? Thank you.
Maya, thank you so much for your testimony. And on behalf of the committee, I just want to say that I'm sorry that that happened to you, that we hear you today, and we are really happy you're here to share your story because it truly makes a difference. So thank you so much. Our next testifier is Ariana Guerra. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the chance to speak before you today. My name is Ariana Guerra, and I'm the Policy and Advocacy Manager at Foster Advocates. In addition to my current role, I've also had the pleasure of serving as a guardian ad litem for the past 5 years, where I advocate for the best interests of children who are in foster care. While these roles technically make me qualified to speak about this issue, I'm also speaking today because this is personal to me. I was 16 when I entered foster care in Fairborn County. It has been 12 years, and that memory has not faded. I can still picture the room. It was dark, stuffy, had no windows. I walked in alone, and waiting were two social workers. But I was able to tell them what happened, and when I walked back out, I was told I had now entered foster care. My life was never the same. I know now that despite my fear, I was lucky. In 2016, I became a guardian ad litem in Ramsey County. So for the first time, I was on the other side of that very same table. Every day I met so many amazing children and families. I met a lot of people just like Maya. You heard Maya testify today about her amazing support system, but you also heard about the fears that were still present. The fear of not being believed, the fear of being treated differently, having to face your abuser. The way that the statute is currently written is harmful. It lacks one simple requirement. The change being proposed would ensure that investigators are held to the standard of interviewing children separately from their alleged abuser, instead of being dependent on a social worker who is just going above and beyond. Just as we would handle a criminal case where an individual is assaulted on the street, we would never force this victim to make their statement in front of their perpetrator. And we would certainly never let that person drive the victim home. So, why is this acceptable for our most vulnerable children? We should never forget that foster children are our children. I know that we cannot protect them from all the dangers of this world, and oh, I wish we could. But one thing we can absolutely do is grant them the most basic protections when it matters most. And that includes the right to be interviewed safely and separately from your abuser, regardless of who they are in your life. These moments of truth are rare, and we must be approached carefully. There are a lot of Mayas out there just waiting to be heard. I know we can do better, and supporting Bill HF 3971 will allow us to do just that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Guerra. We can move now on to member questions because I don't think we have any other testifiers. I'm not seeing any hands. I'll just say that I'm rather shocked that this is even going on. And so this is really important bill, and I want to thank Chair Becker-Finn for bringing this bill. I don't see any hands up, so Chair Becker-Finn, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I think Maya's testimony speaks for itself, and the idea of forcing a child in a situation where they are a child is making a decision that so directly relates to their personal safety and well-being is really, I think, goes against most of our values and what we think of when we think of ideally what we're trying to do with our child protection system and keeping kids safe. And ultimately, that's what this bill is about, is making sure that we can keep more kids like Maya safe. And I just want to thank Maya again. That was really a great testimony. And it's not lost on me that even if we do it with a smiling face, to tell stories about our trauma can have impacts on us, and it can be a difficult thing to do, even if we do it willingly. And so I'm really grateful to Maya and others who have come forward to advocate for this legislation. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, I do see Representative Scott. Your hand was up, but now it's nipped down.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to ask a question then, but the author already gave her closing comments, so I'll find the answer offline. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Representative Scott. Chair Becker-Finn.
Yeah, thank you. And I appreciate it, Representative Scott. And just, you know, as with any bill, you know, this is going to Human Services. We're going to continue to work on this language to make it better. I have a meeting scheduled with DHS and ways we can improve on the language to make sure we're not creating any problems and are really getting this language as good as we can. And, you know, that's the idea of the legislative process. And I'm certainly open to speaking more with you and others to make sure that we get this right. So with that, I will close up and renew my motion that House File 3971 be referred to the Human Services Committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. The clerk will take the roll.
Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Grossel?
Aye.
Herr?
Aye.
Hollins?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
Aye.
Novotny?
Bonnie, aye.
Farr?
Aye.
Robbins?
Aye.
Bang?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
That is 17 ayes and 0 nays.
All right, the motion prevails and House File 3971 is on its way to the Human Services Committee. I will turn the gavel back over to Chair Beckerfin.
Great. Thank you, Vice Chair Mueller, and thank you, members. I guess a testament to never knowing how long anything's really going to take in the legislature. I do want to, we don't have any other bills on our agenda today, but I do want to thank everybody for their time and attention this week. We got a lot done. A lot of judiciary bills have been passed off the House floor as well already this year, and I just really appreciate everyone's attention to this important work. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wondering if you have any ideas as we're getting closer to deadline weeks and everything. Do you have any roadmap, any idea next week if there are going to be any evening hearings?
Yep. Thank you, Representative Scott. That was going to be the next thing I was going to get to, but we're on the same page. We will be meeting again next Tuesday evening. My goal is to get everything done within our Tuesday and Thursday normal times, and then an additional Tuesday evening hearing. And, you know, as you and I have talked about, you know, I could waive hearing a bunch of these bills so they're not in front of us, but that isn't the way that I operate. I would rather have those of us, especially with these data practices and this specialized knowledge, in front of our committee. And, I guess we can hold on to the fact that we're a very important committee that needs to vet a lot of bills. But, you know, we'll try to keep things as efficient as we can as far as testifiers and our communication with chief authors. But it would be in my intent. So when you see the posting for next Tuesday, it's going to be it's going to be a lot of bills. But as we all know, some of those might drop off and, you know, amendments. There's like a lot that can happen. But I do want to notice as many things as we can. If we have the time, we'll take as long as it's going to take on Tuesday. I do think, you know, I'm not one to cut off a discussion too early if folks want to discuss things. So that would be my intention. And then to keep in mind that there's a chance that bills that if we don't get to them on Tuesday, they may roll over into Thursday, but everything would be noticed with enough time that we know that it's coming. Do you have any other further questions, Representative Scott?
No, Madam Chair, that's good. Thank you for elaborating on
that. Yeah, thank you. And we'll make sure, too, that staff is in contact with your staff as well if there are any changes to that plan. But that's the plan for next week. So thank you, everybody. Enjoy the rest of your St. Patrick's Day. And with that, we are adjourned.